بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله وسلم وبارك على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم أما بعد السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Welcome once again. Alhamdulillah. This is our third session covering the Fard Ain, the personally obligatory knowledge. The first two sessions were really just introductions. So in session one, we talked about what Fard Ain really is and its importance and the structure of this program. And last week, we talked about module one, which is about theology, aqidah, what we believe. And we talked about why that's important, the different names for it, and we gave an overview of what we're going to be studying. And today marks the beginning of that module in the proper sense of the word. So we're starting with a really fancy word in English called epistemology. And that word really means how we know what we know. A person may wonder, why are we even talking about how we know what we know? I thought we were talking about aqidah, belief in Allah, belief in the messengers, and these things. Why are we talking about this? The answer is that the objective in aqidah is to have knowledge that is certain knowledge, yaqeen, jazm, certain knowledge, conviction. And you can't have that without knowledge. Allah Ta'ala says in the Quran, فَعْلَمْ أَنَّهُ لَا إِلَهَ إِنَّ اللَّهِ. Know that there is no God worthy of worship except Allah. So we start with learning to how we know what we know, because our belief, our inner conviction about reality, about the divine and everything, it's about absolute truth. Because truth is not a construct. It's not something we build, it's something we discover. The human mind doesn't create truth. The human mind doesn't construct truth, it discovers truth. So we have to begin with this question of how do we know anything at all? How do we know what we know? And so we start with some questions today. Is there an absolute truth? Is there anything that we can say is an absolute truth? Yes or no?
Yes.
As Muslims, we have no trouble saying that. We believe in absolute truth. We believe, as do most human beings, that it is possible for us to arrive at truth, to understand truth. Is truth relative? Well, that's another question, because if there's anything we can say about this day and age that we're in, is that people like to make everything relative, right? They say that 3 out of 4 Americans say there is no such thing as absolute ultimate truth. Truth is treated like a fairy tale. People will tell you, this is my truth, and that's your truth. You live your truth. Believe whatever you want. Do whatever is best for you. Do whatever you feel is right. It's right for you. It may not be right for me. It may be true for you, but it's not true for me. But you live your truth as long as you don't hurt anyone. And of course, you have to be tolerant, because people who don't believe in absolute truth do believe it's an absolute truth that you have to be tolerant of every single viewpoint, because every viewpoint is valid because there's no absolute truth. Everyone has their own perspective. This is all what we call sophistry. That's an ancient belief that there's no way of really knowing anything at all. As Muslims, we don't believe that. We believe we can access truth. We can know absolute truth. And anyone who says otherwise is just pulling the wool over people's eyes using clever word games. Because if a person says there is no absolute truth, there's a very simple way to counter them. You ask them a question. They say to you, this is all relative. You have your perspective, I have mine. There's no absolute truth. It's all a matter of perspective. You say to them, your statement that there is no absolute truth, Is that statement absolutely true or not? Is it? If they say, yes, it is absolutely true that there's no absolute truth, what do you have here? You have a contradiction, because they're saying there is no absolute truth and my claim is absolute. It's the absolute truth. They've refuted their own statement. So if they say no, then they basically affirm that there is an absolute truth. So to say that there is no such thing as absolute truth, it's the same thing as a person going onto a chalkboard and writing, there is no such thing as writing. Well, what is that? That's writing. And the writing says there's no such thing as writing. Saying there's no absolute truth is either absolute or it's not absolute. It's a self-defeating argument. So we believe that it is possible for us to arrive at absolute truth. And that truth is not subject to a person's opinion, their mood. It's not subject to one's culture. It's not relative, where what is true for you is not true for me. No, truth with a capital T is absolute and accessible to human beings. Now, what's a real life application of this? What would this look like in the modern world? This belief that everything is relative, everything's up in the air, everything's fuzzy. So imagine your child comes to you one day and they say, Mom, Dad, why are we Muslim? And you say to them, we're Muslim because the Quran tells us to be Muslim. Your son or daughter says to you, but Billy at school was Christian and they have a Bible and his parents tell him that they're Christian because the Bible says so. So the Christian kid is saying the same thing that the Muslim kid is saying. And the parents may say, yes, but our book is true. And Billy says, well, that's what they say about the Bible as well. So it looks to me like we're all the same and no one's absolutely right. Everyone has something right. We're in this together. All of these paths, all of these religions, they're all paths that lead to the summit. They all lead to this truth, and we all have our different ways of doing things. That's when things are seen as relative. So how do you reply to this? You can't reply by saying Islam is haq, it's truth, because the Quran says so. Because every religion says that about themselves. You have to understand how to think. If you don't answer this question properly, what you are doing is putting the seed of doubt in a young Muslim's mind who is already living in an environment that is full of moral relativism. So you have to say there's an absolute truth, and you can assess that truth, you can access it. So you have to know what it means to know. You have to know what knowledge really is, and you have to know what masquerades as knowledge. You have to know what is real knowledge, ilm, and what may seem like knowledge, but it's not real knowledge. So that leads us to the important question of tonight. What is knowledge? Now we're going to give a general definition and a specific definition, and we're not trying to overcomplicate this, and I think it'll all be made very clear quite soon. When we talk about knowledge, it's basically to ascertain or to grasp something. It is to attain it, to reach it, to have access to it. So we say that knowledge, in this general definition, is to have access to truth. Access to truth. This is how it is expressed in Arabic as well. Idrak al-shay. To have access to a thing, ala ma huwa alay, as it really is. To have access. This is the general definition of knowledge. So if I ask you, and I will be asking you soon, what is the general meaning of knowledge? What's the key word to define that? Access. To have access to something. Access to truth. Now, There are certain things that knowledge, we say knowledge is access, and then there's things that are counterfeit or masquerade as knowledge or are the opposite of knowledge. So we have, for example, ignorance. That's the opposite. If I ask you, what is the capital of Nepal? Who knows the answer? Someone, quickly. Okay, that's not jahl. That's knowledge. You know. If you said, I don't know, that would be jahl. So that's just not knowing. You also have a false guess. And this is answering correctly, or a true guess is answering correctly. A false guess is answering incorrectly and is basically a form of ignorance. Then you have the true guess. This is when you guess correctly, but you didn't have true access. So keep that word in mind, access to that thing. Then you have doubt, where it's 50-50. This thing, maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, I don't know, I'm in doubt. It's 50-50. And lastly is blind imitation. Someone tells you that it's XYZ, you don't know for yourself, you don't have true access yourself, but you parrot what they say and you don't really know for yourself, but you're just imitating what someone else said. You're parroting what they said. So this is what knowledge is not. Now, as far as the specific definition goes, we said the main definition for knowledge is what? Access to truth. To have access to truth as it really is. The more specific definition is to say that it is conviction that corresponds to the reality and based on proof. I'm going to repeat that. But before we get to that, I want to ask you this important question. What's in my pocket? Okay, now I want you to raise your hand and volunteer an answer. And then I will share the true answer. What's in my wallet? Not my wallet. What's in my pocket?
I don't know.
That's a good answer. That's a good answer. Why don't you know?
Because you haven't told me. I have no way of getting access to that knowledge.
You don't have access. Okay, we need more than I don't know, though. Give me an answer. Yes. My phone. Okay, well, my phone is right here, so that's that was a false guess. I could have a second phone. I don't. Not here. Yes.
Driver's license.
Wrong. Yes.
Nothing.
Wrong. Yes. My keys. Wrong. Okay. There's a reason why I'm asking this question. And that is because there are ways we can know. If you don't have access, you're not going to have the correct answer. What's your name, brother?
Muhammad
said, I don't know. That's a good answer because he has no access. Some of you said keys. Some of you said phone. Some of you said a driver's license. And you're all wrong. And even if I had keys, if I had keys in my pocket and you said keys, would that be true knowledge?
No.
Why not?
Because
it's called a true guess. It's a true guess. So you can make a correct guess. And I pull out keys because when you're asking me, I meant this pocket, not this pocket. But you didn't have access, so you don't have true knowledge of it. It just so happens, well, you inferred, okay, most people when they're out and about, they have keys in their pocket, they have a wallet in their pocket, they have a phone in their pocket. That's why no one said you have a pigeon in your pocket, because who walks around with a bird, right? You mentioned the things that are common, but they're all guesses because you have no access. Now, I want someone to come up here, and I'm going to whisper to them what I have in my right pocket. Who's going to volunteer? I need to get someone who's very well known. Maqsad, I need you to come up here. And there's a reason why I say well known. It can't be someone except that they're well known. All right.
I'm going to whisper to Maqsad what I have in my pocket. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to volunteer? Do you want to share with the class what I said is in my pocket?
Yeah.
What is it?
Bottle of perfume.
Okay. A bottle of perfume. A bottle of atar. All right. So we're going to believe Maqsad because Maqsad, we know him. He's trustworthy. Do you have knowledge now? You do. You do have knowledge. But it's not quite like the knowledge of a person who sees the bottle of perfume. So you trusted Maqsad when he said it's a bottle of perfume. But notice now how you have even more certainty because you see it, right? These are two ways of knowing. You had no access to this. Even if you said bottle of perfume, you would have been wrong because you didn't have access. And how did you get access first?
Because he said it.
Because he's trustworthy and he shared with us that it's a bottle of perfume. That is called the sound report that we have here in the slide. The three ways of knowing, number one is the sound report, al-khabru sadiq. So he conveyed to you that it's a bottle of perfume. You trust him, and so you came to knowledge about what this thing is. Because why? He had access. Now, I told him and he didn't see it. I probably should have showed it to him, but then you would have seen it and had access yourself. But if I had shown this to him under the table, he would have had direct access. He would have seen it with his own eyes. And then he shares it with you what he saw. And because you trust him, you have a kind of access as well. So there's three ways we know. You can sit down. There's three means of knowledge or three ways of having access. The first one is the sound report. The sound report is coming from someone trustworthy who has seen something and who's reporting back what he saw or what he sensed. The second one is the sound senses, al-hawas al-sarima. So we have your eyes, what else? Your ears, your sense of hearing, your sense of sight, your sense of smell, your sense of touch, and your taste. So the five senses, we call those, if they are sound and they're not faltering in some way due to sickness or whatever, that is a means of knowing. And the third means, which is the most important of all of these, is reason. Now, this is a physical object, so you would have access to this, knowing what's in my pocket by either seeing it or hearing a report from someone trustworthy who has seen it, telling you that it's a bottle of perfume. What if I told you that instead of a bottle of perfume in my pocket, I have a square circle? Would you ask me to show it to you?
No.
Why not?
Yes.
Why not?
You would want to see it to get access.
Right. If I said I have a square circle in my pocket, if you think I should take it out and show you, raise your hand. Okay, most of you. If you think that's absurd and there's no way I could take it out of my pocket and show you, raise your hand. Okay, it's about equal. Why not?
Because it's not logically possible.
You say, okay, square is something, it's four sides of equal length. Circle, something with a circumference, is no sides. The two terms cancel each other out. So if I say I have a square circle in my pocket, you shouldn't need to say, show me, because you know that's absurd. That's the reason. That's the aql. You don't have to see it because there's no seeing of that thing. And it doesn't matter if Maqsad tells you he saw a square circle. If he tells you, yeah, Ustaz showed me a square circle, you can say he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's speaking absurdities because that's not logically possible. So these are the three ways we know things. We have access through these senses. So we said knowledge, in the general sense, is about access to truth. The more particular definition that we're coming back to is having conviction. You have conviction in your heart, like we say jazm or yaqeen, certainty and conviction, that is congruent with reality, mutabiq lilwaqi'. It corresponds to reality, an dalil, based on a proof. It is to have access to truth, to access to reality, as it really is, with proof. That is the more specific definition. So if we say, do you have knowledge of this bottle of perfume? Do you have conviction that this was in my pocket? Yes. Does your belief correspond to reality? Yes, because you had access. You had proof, which is seeing it. Does this make sense? Now you're going to see how this all applies to our aqidah, our belief, what we believe. So you see the bottle, and now you know it through sense perception, the hawas. Before that, you heard it from a trustworthy person, and they should have seen it too, and he informed you. You wouldn't believe in a square circle in my pocket because you know that is rationally absurd. So, you wouldn't ask me to show you a square circle. You don't need to do that. Your rational mind understands there's no such thing, as they are contradictions in terms. So, with these means of knowing, whether it's the sound report, the senses, or our aqal, we make judgments about reality. We make judgments about things. So we say A is B, right? The water is hot. Alcohol is haram. This is called a judgment, a proposition, a hukum. We talk about hukum in Arabic, we think of the Islamic hukum as in halal and haram. What is the hukum? The Islamic legal ruling. But there's more than just that. We want to talk about the three types of judgments we make and how this applies to our beliefs. Before we can go into these judgments, however, we have to discuss the meaning of hukum itself. When you say hukum, you mean judgment. You mean proposition. A claim is being made. You're making a statement that A is B, or A is not B, right? We make them every single day. Anything we say like this is called a hukum. If you say, I'm tired, I'm hungry, Zayd is standing, Maryam is laughing, these are all judgments. We're saying A is B or A is not B. It's either affirmative or negative. There is an ascription between these two things, a nisba. So we have affirmative, X is Y, or X is not Y, that's negational. This is a hukum, and we do this every single day. It's like prose, you speak prose every day, and that's the reality. So we say Zayd is standing, we ascribe standing to Zayd. Zayd is standing. Or we say Zayd is not standing. So again, there's an ascription, a nisba between Zayd and whatever you say. When you say Zayd is not standing, what are you negating? Standing. Does that mean he's sitting? Because, maybe, in reality, maybe. But when you say Zayd is not standing, you're just negating standing. You're not affirming that he's sitting. He could be floating in space for all we know. You understand? So we have to be very precise with our words when we make these judgments. So we make the statement like Zayd is standing, Maryam is laughing, the water is hot, alcohol is haram, it is cold outside. We make these statements and we're not necessarily confirming whether they're true or false. We're just understanding what is being said with respect to what. After we understand the relationship between the two, then we can examine it. Because it's a claim. It's either an ethical claim, alcohol is haram. That's an ethical claim. Stealing is bad. That's an ethical claim. So it's a hukum that applies to behavior. Or you could say, Zayd is standing, Maryam is sitting, Fulan is laughing. These are not legal ethical claims. They are claims based on observation. Right? We're looking. We see that Zayd is sitting or standing. We see Maryam is laughing and so on. That's an observation. Or we say something like, 1 + 1 = 2. Is that something we're observing with our eyes somewhere? Is that a legal judgment in the Quran? No, that's a rational judgment. But these are all judgments that we make on a daily basis. So, after we find evidence, we have sufficient knowledge of a thing, we figure out what is going on with A and B, we can look at the ascription. After that, we can say, oh, this is true, or this is false. If I say, Zayd is standing, that might be true, it might be false. How will you know if it's true or not? Okay, let's say there's a Zayd here, and someone says, Zayd is sitting. How would we know if that's a true statement or not? We have to look at Zayd. And say Zayd is behind us. Someone says, Zayd is sitting. You don't see him, he's behind you. That may be true, it might be false. If the person who tells you is trustworthy, and you believe him, that would be your access. But how does he know? Because he saw Zayd. Now you could turn around and see Zayd is sitting, and now you have access. So the claim is made, and after you understand what is A and B in this claim or judgment, it's then upon you to figure out if it's true or not. Right? When people make judgments, they have to justify what they say. If I say Zayd is sitting, you have every right to say, how do you know? It's not for me to say, Zayd is sitting, and when you say, how do you know? I say, that's not my problem. You have to prove that he's not sitting. That's not on me. I'm the one making the claim. So I have to prove it if someone says, how do you know? How do you have access to that? Maybe I heard it from someone else, and they heard it from someone else, and they heard it from someone else, in which case we have to figure out, are these people trustworthy? You know, is there some corruption here? Are they conspiring? You know, so it gets deeper and deeper, but we have to have access through these different ways. So that's an important thing. When we say hukum or judgment, A is B, Zayd is standing, whatever we say, we have to justify it. It is a responsibility we bear to back that up by showing how we have access to that. If we don't have access to that, are we speaking with knowledge? No. It's either ignorance in the form of a false guess, or it's a true guess, or we're just blindly following someone and they don't have access either. We're just parroting what they say. None of that is real knowledge. Real knowledge is having access. Okay? Now, we're going to come back to these next week. I was attempting to do all of this tonight, and I realized that's not going to happen. So we're going to spend 2 weeks on this stuff. So some of the stuff that we're covering today, we're going to cover again, but in a little more detail. Specifically, its application. But I want to put a seed in your mind right now, just to think about. You have two types of people. You have the atheist, and you have the agnostic. Do they make claims? Yes. They do. Yeah. The atheist makes a claim. They say, there is no God. The agnostic makes a claim as well by saying, I don't know if there is a God. I want you to think about those two claims and how they use them when they call to atheism or agnosticism. We're going to explore that next week, inshallah. I'm just putting that idea in your mind right now. So we understand that knowledge is access. Access to a thing as it really is. And that access is our proof. That's our dalil. When we say, what is your proof? That means, what is your access card? The dalil, the proof, is the access card. And there's three primary ways of having access. What are those three ways? We said the sound senses, or the sound report, what we hear from someone trustworthy. And the last one is reason. Right? So that's how we have access. When we're making claims or making judgments about things, A is B, A is not B, we understand there's three types of judgments. Three types. And we're going to look at two of them in detail, and one of them we'll be postponing until we get to module 2, which is all about the first judgment of these three. So we have three. Number one is the legal judgment. The legal judgment, which we call in Arabic al-hukmu al-shar'i. Al-hukmu al-shar'i is the legal judgment. That is Allah's judgment concerning the actions of human beings. So if you say, Fajr prayer is fard, is that a judgment or a claim?
Yeah.
You know, Fajr is A, is fard, fard, that's B. So there's an ascription here. Now, how do you have access to that? How do you know that to be the case? Through the Quran, through the Hadith. But that judgment, is that a judgment you make using your eyes and ears, or your taste or touch? Is it through observing nature that you discover that Fajr is fard? No. It's through Allah's address in the Quran. So that's the legal judgment. So when we talk about judgments, we think something that's wajib, that you have to do, something that's haram, that you cannot do, it's forbidden, something that is disliked, makruh, or recommended, mustahab, or mubah, neutral. Those are all legal judgments. We're not focusing on those until module 2. We're looking at judgment number 2 and judgment number 3. We have the rational judgment, which is the judgment of the mind that does not depend on revelation or the observation of nature. Right? For example, if I say 1 plus 1 equals 2, your mind conceives of that and knows it cannot be other than that. Do you need to find a verse of the Quran to affirm that 1 plus 1 equals 2? Do you need a hadith? You don't. Because it doesn't depend on revelation for you to affirm. If we say there's no such thing as a square circle, can you say, where does it say that in the Quran? Or, I can't believe that until I see it in the Quran. Would you make that argument? No, you wouldn't make that argument, because your mind knows automatically. That's just, this is a contradiction in terms. So the rational judgment is the judgment of the mind that doesn't depend on revelation or the observation of nature. If I say to you, 1 plus 1 equals 2, for you to agree with me, you simply need to hear it. You don't tell me, hold on, I'm not sure about that, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Let me put that under a microscope and examine it. Let me go out into nature and see if I can figure that out. Because the answer is not in nature. The answer, it's intuitive. It's something your mind immediately picks up on. Now, if I say 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 7 divided by 2, that would also give you certain knowledge that's rationally necessary, but it's not going to come so quickly. You have to think about it, right? So some things are fast, some things come quickly, some things don't come so quickly. But that's the rational judgment. Empirical judgment. This is our third one. And these last two, I said, are the most important in Aqidah. The empirical judgment. What is empirical? Think of the senses. Right? What you can sense, what you can observe, what you can measure. That's called the empirical judgment. The empirical judgment is the judgment gained through the senses and repetition. Right? This is basically how we figure out how to survive in the world as human beings. Trial and error. You make certain judgments. The snake is poisonous. The rattlesnake is poisonous. How do you know?
You might not know, but you might believe it if you hear it, but you might not know, and you can like go check in nature.
If you check in nature, you might get bit, and you discover right then when it's too late.
Or you can like look it up on something.
Or you could look it up. How would you know that a rattlesnake is poisonous? Yes. Right, and not just one person. You know, we're talking hundreds of people, thousands of people throughout history. We observe this kind of snake when it rattles and strikes something, it injects a poison, a toxin, a venom. So rattlesnakes are poisonous. If you say the food is spoiled, how would you know? Well, it's through observation that when the food turns this color and smells this way, we've observed that people who eat that get sick. Maybe you haven't experienced that, but your parents tell you, don't eat that, it's spoiled. Well, how do they know? Well, they heard it too, and they learned it from the multitude of human beings who have experienced this through observation and through repetition, meaning it's happened so many times, they've established a pattern, a causal norm. Tylenol, it helps relieve headaches. That's through trial and error, right? So basically, when we say empirical judgment, we're saying scientific judgment. Because the domain of science is observation, trial and error, repetition, and establishing patterns. Establishing patterns. And that's why in Arabic, this empirical judgment is called al-hukm al-adi. Because it's from ada ya'udu, this constant repetition. That's how you are able to establish patterns in creation, right? So it's based on his, your senses, and it's based on repetition. Now here, I have a phone, and you see this phone, and I'm gonna drop it. I'm gonna let it go. Drop it again, drop it again, drop it again, drop it again. I can do that 1 million times, and guess what's gonna happen when I do it 1 million and one times? What's gonna happen?
Same thing.
I have established a pattern through observation. Now, we're gonna talk more about this next week because there's some really important things to understand about that. But that's basically what a hukum adi is. Now, the empirical judgment or scientific judgment. Let's give you the definition of this. It's basically affirming a relationship between two things in terms of existence or non-existence by the medium of repetition and the possibility of delay, as well as there being absolutely no effect from one to the other. That's a mouthful. So we're going to come back to that and look at that in some detail, but that's the definition. The point here is that, yes, I can observe through repetition time and time again. I can establish a pattern on which to predict what's going to happen next. This is a great mercy from Allah, because without that, how would you do anything? If you drop the phone and it turns into a tiger, and then the next time it happens, well, you're dead, but let's say it happens again and it turns into a bottle of water. If life was like that, you can make no predictions about what's going to happen next. There's no patterns. And there's no way you can survive in the world like that. So the ada is a great mercy from Allah Ta'ala. It's Allah's creation. And we take it for granted as if it's going to happen automatically, even though it is Allah creating that link between the cause and the effect. And we'll talk more about that next week, inshallah. So it is based on observation. This is the domain of science. Science is concerned with establishing the pattern, the norm, through empirical observation. And that is the only domain science can operate in. Science can only operate in the realm of the observable. Science can never answer questions about why. They can only analyze patterns and make predictions based on those patterns and establish correlations and hopefully causation, and that's science. It doesn't go beyond the circle of observed reality that we see with the senses. So that is the scientific judgment. And you're wondering, well, why are we talking about this? We're going to tie those loose ends up very soon, inshallah. Now, the rational judgment, again, there's that A is B or A is not B. It's the judgment that affirms or negates something from something else, X from Y, but does not rely on the Sharia or empirical observation. As we said, 1 + 1 = 2, you don't need a hadith to affirm that. You don't need an ayah to affirm that. A square circle, you negate that, and you don't need an ayah or a hadith to negate that. If I say there's a cup of sweet tea on the table, do you need a hadith or an ayah to affirm that? No. Because that's a possibility that you can observe. Could be, could not be. Maybe, may not be. So that is the rational judgment. And it's not based on observation for saying 1 + 1 = 2. Observation for saying there's no such thing as a square circle. Now, for the last one, you would need to observe. But at the very least, for a cup of sweet tea on the table, you could say that's a possibility. Whether it's factually true or not, that remains to be seen. But at least in your mind's eye, you know, well, that's possible. To say that there's a cup of sweet tea on the table is not the same thing as saying 1 + 1 = 2. Right? It's just possible. So this means that there's types of judgments. The rational judgment is basically how we make sense of everything around us. Without aql, without the rational mind, none of us would be accountable before Allah Ta'ala. That is the condition of moral responsibility. The condition for being accountable for the do's and don'ts of Islam and accountable before Allah is having aql. Right? So you have to know what these categories or these types of judgments are. But guess what? You already know them. You already know them because you are rational human beings. You may not know these terms that we're introducing, but when they're explained to you, you know them intuitively. You know them. If I say 1 + 1 = 2, and you know it has to be that, it can't be other than that, you now know what is rationally necessary, even if you've never heard that term before. So it's not that people need to know these terms, but they need to be familiar with this way of thinking so they can be clearer in how they think about matters of aqidah. Right? So the three types are simply necessary, impossible, impossible. There's no fourth category. Can you think of a fourth category? A fourth type that goes outside of these three? Something either must be or it cannot be in any case, or it might be or it might not be. Can you think of a fourth?
Probably.
That's possibly. Right? Meaning it could be, could may not be. So you have three. Imam al-Juwayni, Imam al-Haramain, one of the great scholars, the teacher of Imam al-Ghazali, he has a very famous statement that was somewhat controversial. He said that if a person doesn't know these three types of rational judgments, they are legally unaccountable. They're not accountable. They are غير عاقل. They're not intelligent to the point where they're no longer accountable in Sharia. Basically, they don't have a mind. Now, I remember a person many years ago was saying something about these things and said, well, no, there's a fourth category. What's that? He said, the fourth category is the Quran and the Sunnah. And the answer is, okay, number one, you don't understand what a rational judgment is. And number two, how do you affirm the Quran as the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? It's through your mind understanding truth. So that's a false argument. So these are the three types of rational judgments. Necessary, wajib aqli, it must be. It cannot not be. That's a double negative, but that's what it is. It cannot be envisioned that it cannot be. That's a mouthful. 1 + 1 = 2. Could it ever be other than that? It must be. The part is smaller than the whole. That's necessary, rationally necessary. Can it be other than that? Absolutely not. Right? Impossible is the opposite. It cannot be under any circumstances. All intellects come to the same conclusion. Now, we say that all intellects come to the same conclusion. So why do people differ about matters of belief? Some believe in three gods and one, some believe in millions, some believe in none. Why are there so many people differing even though they claim to be based on truth? Because they're not using their aql. They're not using their aql properly. And this is why Allah addresses us in the Quran by saying that we will be questioned on the Day of Judgment. Inna sam'a wal basara wal fu'ad kullu ula'ika kana anhu mas'ula. Indeed, the hearing and the sight and the heart will all be questioned. The hearing, al-khabr al-sadiq. That's what comes to you from people, right? That is the truthful report, right? That's the hukum. Al-basar is what you see. That's the empirical. And then the fu'ad, the heart, that's the aql. That's your intelligence. Allah criticizes people for not using their aql, not using their intelligence. So the opposite of impossible is the opposite of necessary. And lastly, possible. It might be or it might not be. Now I have this clever picture. I googled Google Images for square circle, and this is what came up. Is that a square circle?
No.
What is that?
It's a circle made out of squares.
Right? So people can play word games. Like, oh, they say 1 + 1 doesn't always have to equal 2. Through some word games, they'll say, well, if you have one pair of shoes plus one pair of shoes, that equals 4 shoes. But that's a word game because a pair of shoes consists of how many shoes? 2. So, yeah. So we have these three rational judgments. Now, I want to give some examples for these and then give you homework and tie this all together. Now, let's think of necessary. We've already given a few. 1 + 1 = 2. Basic mathematics. The part is smaller than the whole. The whole is greater than the part. What about impossibilities? Let's say, you have one?
3 = 1.
3 = 1. Right, you see, 3 by definition is, well, 3. 1 is a single unit, a single number. Each term cancels out the other. Square is a four-sided object of equal length. A circle is that which has no sides and equal circumference. Each terms contradict the other, right? What about moving and still at the same time? Is that possible? Okay. And anyone want to elaborate on that one? Can something be moving and still at the same time?
Yes. It depends on your frame of reference.
Excellent. Yeah. It depends on your frame of reference, your vantage point. Okay, so you're sitting in your living room and someone drives down the road. You see them in the passenger side. Are they moving from your vantage point? Absolutely. And they're sitting still. And that's at the same time. So from your vantage point, yes, that's possible. But from their vantage point, so let's say this object, this phone, can this phone be moving and still at the same time from the same vantage point, from its own vantage point? Is that possible? No, right? Let's see something else. Can you think of any examples of what is rationally impossible?
Tall, short.
Huh?
Tall, short. Tall, short.
Tall, short. Yeah. A married bachelor. Why is that logically impossible? If we agree that bachelor means someone who's unmarried, and married means they're betrothed, each term cancels out the other. So it is about looking at the meaning of words, right? Before you can say yes or no or possible, impossible, you have to say, well, what does bachelor mean? Do you have some meaning for it that's not common? Right? If you have your own meaning, then that's another conversation. But yes, married bachelor, bright darkness, things like this, right? All of this is important. All of this has to do with our aqidah. Now, why do we talk about the empirical judgment, what we observe from nature through repetition, in the subject of aqidah? Here's an easy question to bring that home. Is it rationally possible? Meaning, can your mind envision this? Is it rationally possible for a human being, without the aid of a spacecraft or a suit or any supporting element, to travel from this earth throughout multiple galaxies and return in the same night? Is that rationally possible? Rationally possible. If you say it's rationally possible, raise your hand. If you say that's rationally impossible, raise your hand. Okay. Why would you say it's rationally impossible?
There's no precedence there. There's no evidence that I can come up with.
سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى.
That's only for the Prophet, not for ordinary.
But I ask, is it rationally possible? If it's rationally impossible, that means your mind cannot conceive of it, which means it's no one can do it. You understand? But there's no verse in the Quran that's going to tell you 1 + 1 = 3. You see what's going on here? Most people, because of the world, the time we're living in, and because we're so engrossed in materialism, we tend to think that if something is not observable, it's either not real, and if it's scientifically impossible, it's rationally impossible. People conflate between what is scientifically impossible and what is rationally impossible. Is it rationally possible for a person to go through the solar system like that? Yes, rationally. Now, scientifically, is that possible, given what we have today of technology? No, it's not possible. It is not possible, at least not empirically. We haven't observed that, and it seems like that would be scientifically impossible to put a human being through space going through multiple galaxies without any of that technology. Scientifically, that seems like a done deal. But rationally speaking, our minds can envision that as a possibility. That's not the same thing as saying 1 + 1 = 5. You understand the difference? This is why we need to focus a little bit on this. Because if a person mixes up the empirical judgment with the rational judgment, they have to deny the miracles of the prophets. Because the prophets of Allah were given miracles by Allah that broke those scientific patterns and norms that were created by Allah. Allah gave those things to them. So it's not a question of 1 plus 1 equaling 3. That's always impossible. It's a question of certain norms that we observe being broken. The splitting of the moon. Is that rationally possible?
Yes.
Yeah, rationally possible. Now, empirically, it's a factual occurrence, but we would say empirically impossible based on us as human beings attempting it with what we have of technology. Water emerging from between someone's fingers and filling a large container that people didn't drink from. Is that rationally possible? Yeah. There's nothing in the mind that says that's like a square circle. It's possible. Now, scientifically, will we say that's possible? No. But the scientific judgment is a judgment based on observing nature, observing patterns, and those patterns can always be broken by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He creates the patterns, He breaks the patterns. To bring that home one more time, if you have a cane and you throw it down 1,000 times, is it ever going to turn into something else? No. But has there ever been a cane that was thrown down that turned into something else?
Snake.
Right. The staff of Musa, alayhi salam.
Is it rationally possible to repeat it?
For whom?
That process.
The process? If Allah gives you a karama, a miracle, that would be the break of some kind of norm. So let's say a person is able to walk on water. They're running away from an enemy, and they start walking on water. Scientifically, empirically, we'd say that's impossible. But rationally, that's possible. And if Allah breaks the norm and allows a person to walk on water, that's completely within the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He can do that, right? We'll get more into these things as we go into the aqidah, but we have to understand these terms because people say that Allah has partners. People say different things about Allah. We have to understand what is necessary for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What is impossible, rationally speaking, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Possible for Allah to have partners? Rationally impossible. Right? And then what is possible? Doing whatever He wills. We're going to get into that later when we talk about the content of the aqidah, but this is just learning how to think. So, as I said earlier, you all know these rational judgments, even if you've never heard these terms before. But you have to get used to thinking in these terms. And you have to also be very careful to distinguish between what is empirically impossible, or it seems to be empirically impossible based on what we know of from accumulated science, and what is rationally impossible. This is why people deny miracles. They read the Quran about the Isra and the Mi'raj, and because they have this scientistic mindset, not scientific mindset, they say, this is unreasonable. How can I believe that a human being travels through space like that? They have a problem with miracles because they think if it can't be done, if it's not proven by science, it's impossible, and therefore it can't be done. It's rationally possible because human being going through space without any spacecraft is possible. There's nothing that renders that equal to saying a square circle, right? And so we'll go through this again with some exercises, but I want to give you homework, and you bring this homework, inshallah, next week. I want to ask you to give me three examples of what is rationally necessary. Three examples of what is rationally impossible, and three examples of what is rationally possible, which is super easy. rational possibility. That's everywhere, everything around us. Bring three examples, inshallah. We'll discuss them. I wouldn't expect that everyone's going to get them right. And that's a good thing, by the way, because you need to learn from those mistakes so that you can separate the categories. The biggest mistake people make is confusing the empirical with the rational, right? And go over the notes, go over the slides, think about some examples, and inshallah, next week we will review this material, go over your examples, go a little bit deeper into these before we go into the actual aqidah content. So there are any questions? We can take a few questions. Yes?
It's one of the rational necessities that there's a God.
Well, that's the point of all of this, isn't it? The point of all of this is to get to that, which is to say that Allah's existence is rationally necessary. He is wajibul wujud. He is the necessary being. And we prove that through observing that we exist and we have a beginning and we have certain qualities of beginning and end and limitation, and we have been created. And the one who created all of this has certain qualities. That's what we're actually getting to. And this is just leading up to that. So yes, Allah's existence, Allah's oneness, Allah's beginninglessness and endlessness, His dissimilarity to created things, His absolute independence and freedom from all need, His power, His will, His knowledge, His hearing, His seeing, His speech, all of these are rationally necessary attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's what we're actually getting to in the next coming classes in the Aqidah module. What we're describing now is how to think, and then we're moving to the content of the Aqidah, and then how to understand that from proofs from the Qur'an and the Sunnah, and also proofs from rational mind. Because again, you cannot say Islam is truth because the Qur'an says so. That is a circular argument. You can't argue with circularity. Ad-dawr, it's not possible. And that's why we focus on this. Any other questions?
There's a question online.
Right.
Brother Luqman asks, is negating dependency of a judgment from observation and true reports the same as dependency of a judgment only on correct definitions of terms used in a judgment?
Can you repeat that?
It's a mouthful, yes. Yeah. Is negating a dependency of a judgment from observation and true reports? So we are negating dependency of a judgment from observation on true reports. Is it the same as dependency of a judgment only on correct definitions of terms used in a judgment? So what I thought he was getting at was that, do we rely on the definition of terms when we make a judgment, especially in the rational?
Yeah, that's a deeper philosophical issue that we would definitely not go into in this class. And this would be dealt with in the science of coinage, ilm al-wada'. How do we know the meanings of terms? How do we establish that? Or ilm al-maqulat. That's a deeper philosophical issue. But on a simple level, we say that, yes, if we're making a judgment, A is B, we have to have a proper tasawwur of what A is, a proper conception of what A is, and a conception of what B is, before we can make the tasdiq, the affirmation one way or the other about, well, what is the hukum, right? That's dealt with in mantiq, that's dealt with in umil maqulat and other things. We have to talk about, this is why we say, define your terms. If someone says A is B, and the other one says, no, A is not B, how do these two people have a meaningful debate? They have to define their terms. Because for this person, A may be something with a completely different definition to person B. And what's happening is they're talking over each other, right? Right? So a person says, I can't think of any easy examples at the moment, but if a person says A is B, and the other person says, no, A is not B. If the person says A is yada, yada, yada.
Square is not equal four sided factor, for example.
Right. If they can both come to an agreement that square means a four sided shape of equal size, they both agree, yes, that's what a square is. Okay, now what's B? If they can agree on what B is, now they can go deeper. If they don't agree on the definitions, they can't go any further. They have to agree on the definitions, or they have to debate about the definitions themselves. Right, that's another topic.
So how important is this class or with the following classes the young minds to attend? If they miss the following classes, I think there could be a chance where, no?
No. No, is they'll catch up. This is I'm not trying to make this. I'm trying to make this as less complicated as possible. You're not required to know these terms. You're not required to know on a deeper level how to think in this way. But the reason why we're doing this is because we are in an environment where we are challenged. We are in an environment where people deny absolute truth, where truth is seen as relative, where people make judgments all the time and they feel they don't have to justify those judgments. So learning these basic tools of how to think, we're able to A, learn our own beliefs, and B, inoculate ourselves against a lot of the noise that we hear in the modern world. Were it not for that, we would say, very simply, you know Allah because when you travel in the desert and you see camel tracks, you know that there was a camel there. So you infer, likewise, the heavens and the earth and everything that exists has to have a maker. That's a logical proof, but it's a very simplified logical proof. What we're doing is taking that kind of logical proof and opening it up a little bit and looking at it in a more precise sense, looking at it with a more technical lens, so we can understand on a deeper level. But if you were just living in the desert and that was what you said, guess what? You have articulated what we're actually getting at, but in a very simple way. Does that make sense? If you miss this and you know the terms, you'll get it.
No, not the terms. The very core essence of Aqidah itself, that's what I was trying to say, is the bunch of classes are very important. The following and following.
Right.
That completes your teaching, right? What Aqidah is. But if you attend this class, and if you don't attend the following classes, you are kind of...
Let's put it this way. If we give the test for Aqidah, and the person gives the correct answers for the content of Aqidah, but incorrect answers for the proofs, they will still have succeeded. We're not going to say, oh, you answered the questions incorrectly, your aqidah is jacked up. We're not going to say that. As long as the content is correct, maybe they are still working through how to articulate those beliefs. You see, when the ulama teach this, they say, it's not a condition that you're able to regurgitate this and repeat it. And it's not a condition for your iman that you're able to respond to other people making false claims and giving false arguments. None of that is important for an average person. It's just that you know. Even if you know in a very general way, and you don't know these terms, and you forgot how to structure the argument, it doesn't matter. As long as you know the content, and you have a very basic understanding of what is rational in the matters of aqidah. That's all.
These classes are recorded, by the way, so they can always watch.
You can watch them again and again.
Doesn't mean we shouldn't come. Sure.
Yes. And for the person who asked the question online, if that doesn't answer the question, maybe type up a follow-up question and elaborate with some examples. We can address that, inshallah. Any other questions? I want to say that again. A lot of people, when they study aqidah for the first time, they get a little intimidated because they're learning these terms. Don't be intimidated. Don't worry about the terms, because they are intuitive. And even if you forget the terms in English and Arabic, you still know that 1 plus 1 equals 2. You're not going to forget that. You still know that what has a beginning cannot be the creator of the heavens and the earth, because it has a beginning. Someone had to decide to originate it. It's very basic thinking. And that's what we're covering. We're just trying to cover the building blocks of how to think, so that when we get to the discussion on the aqidah, we're speaking in a common language where we're all on the same page. Right? So, have no fear. So homework is what? Three examples of what's rationally necessary, impossible, impossible. Excellent. So next week we'll go through that. Wallahu rasuluhu a'lam wa sallallahu wa sallam ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam.